This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. Just days away from the Republican National Convention's opening day in Cleveland, Ohio, the GOP remains fractured, unsure of how to unite behind the only remaining candidate and presumed nominee, Donald Trump. A bizarre situation has unfolded where a faction of Republican delegates are attempting to persuade the party to vet Trump and prevent him from being named the nominee, despite him winning the needed number of delegates. Additionally, several high-profile Republicans have simply decided to boycott the RNC. Among them are Senator Marco Rubio, a former presidential candidate himself, and Arizona Senator John McCain. Congressman Paul Ryan has decided to throw his lot in with Trump, securing a coveted speaking slot at the RNC, but it has fallen to Ryan to try to unite the party behind Trump. Meanwhile, the Democrats, whose convention in Philadelphia follows the RNC, have tied up their last remaining loose string with Senator Bernie Sanders formally endorsing Hillary Clinton for president at a campaign stop in New Hampshire on Tuesday. My guest is David Dayan. He is a contributor to Salon and The Intercept and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times and the New Republic. His new book is called Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the show, David.
Oh, thank you for having me, Sonal.
Thanks for joining us. Well, first, this whole scenario playing out going into the RNC, from your coverage of politics over the years, have you ever seen anything like it in a presidential year?
It is pretty amazing that here we are just less than a week from the beginning of the RNC, and you still have this grumbling over whether the individual who won the race is going to be the nominee. Now, I should say that I don't have a lot of faith in this sort of never Trump faction. I, to be honest, Sonali, I'm not sure that they could organize a trip to Chipotle, much less actually dumping Donald Trump in favor of some other unnamed alternative. But the fact that they can't get on board is in itself sort of indicative of the real crack up in the Republican coalition right now.
So let's actually get into it a little bit. So there's a faction of delegates who are upset about the fact that they might live in states where the party rules require them to throw their lot in with the candidate who won a majority. And so there are people who, you know, started out supporting Marco Rubio or Ted Cruz or whatever, any of these candidates who stepped down and are now upset about having to back Trump. One of them even filed a lawsuit in Virginia and won. But you think that this is basically a desperate last-ditch effort that's going to fail?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at every stop down the line where these people said that they were going to organize and put together some sort of alternative, the problem is that their only organizing principle is never Trump. It's not positive for anyone else. And so,
to be fair, it's never Trump and never Clinton as well, right?
Well, of course. And, so who is the alternative? Who do they turn to? And that's what they can't get together on and can't figure out. And for those who say that you know, Donald Trump, you know, and their view is that Trump will be divisive and cause problems up and down the rest of the Republican ticket, it would be far worse if this faction somehow overturned the will of millions of voters, all of whom would probably say, you know, to heck with it and walk away from the polls in November. So I don't see that the Republican Party has any good options other than going with who the party rank and file chose as who they want to take on Hillary Clinton.
So basically, the party gets to decide how they want to pick their nominee. And I understand that there's still time in the last few days before the convention. that the committee, rules committee, is meeting and could decide. But of course, as you said, some kind of a contested convention or some kind of, you know, rule change at the very last minute would call into question the integrity of the whole process for voters, right?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I remember Donald Trump saying months ago that, and kind of warning and giving kind of an ominous warning that if they tried to overthrow him, there would be riots. And I think he's right. I mean, if you look at his speeches and the kinds of activity that would go on there, I see no reason why, if there was an attempted putsch at in Cleveland, that you wouldn't see the same kind of anger bubble to the surface. And so they're stuck, and really the party, the committees that would be determining this, are all stocked with enough people on the side of Trump that it would be very difficult to get, you know, on the floor of the convention to get enough votes to overturn, you know, to do whatever needs to be done in these various minority reports and conscience clauses, as they call it, so that the individuals on the floor can vote for who they want rather than who they're bound to as delegates. I just don't see a way that you're going to get majority support for that inside the convention hall.
You mentioned that the Dump Trump faction is having a hard time coalescing around an alternative, but John Kasich has emerged as this really interesting figure. Governor of Ohio, running for re-election, also presidential candidate who stepped down, and he hasn't actually decided if he's going to attend the convention that's happening in his own state. So there are, of course, some strong efforts by both the Trump camp and the anti-Trump camp to draft him. What role is Kasich playing here?
Yeah, I mean, John Kasich would be the sort of the last figure that would be able to coalesce the Republican coalition, given where they are. I mean, this is a guy that supported and passed expansion of Medicaid in through the Affordable Care Act, which is like the public enemy number one among the Republican caucus. This is a guy who, even though he was in the race months beyond when Marco Rubio resigned, Marco Rubio still has more pledged delegates at the convention than John Kasich ever did. He won one state. It was his home state. He did pretty much not very well, out of the money in practically every other place that he attempted to run. And I just don't see him being a unifying figure at this convention, given the ideological preoccupations of the Republican Party.
So let's talk about those people who've straight out decided not to attend the Republican Party. And media are not really using the term boycott, but frankly, that's kind of what it is. A number of top Republicans are boycotting their convention, among them John McCain and others. What does this bode for the party?
Well, I think this is purely about electoral politics. You know, I mean, most of the people who are staying away have elections in November in swing states or even blue states, places like Ohio, Florida, Arizona, New Hampshire. Those are the types of senators in particular that you're seeing not be there. Marco Rubio got back into the Senate race in Florida, and that's why he doesn't want to be seen with Trump, because he's running on his own merits for re-election. Same with John McCain, and the same with Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, and the same with Rob Portman in Ohio.
And so you think that if they weren't running their own races, they wouldn't have any, you know, problems with showing up at the RNC?
They would have certainly more of a wherewithal to go along. And the interesting thing is about Paul Ryan, how he is showing up to the Republican convention to give his big speech. What is not really known among a lot of people is that Paul Ryan is in the midst of a primary battle for his seat in Congress. And the last poll that came out showed him with only 43% support. He's still winning the race relative to his challenger, but that's a pretty low number. And so appearing with Trump is probably a calculated move on his part to try to win back that faction before his re-election campaign, which is next month in Wisconsin. So it's really interesting how people are making these individual calculations based on their own political future and whether or not they want to be seen with Trump and draft off his supporters maybe in a primary where they would have more clout, or run screaming away from him in a general election where they think he is a toxic figure.
And of course, the whole House is up for election this year. So Paul Ryan, and I didn't realize this, that he hasn't really passed his primary test in Wisconsin. And certainly if he does pass that, then the general election is another story. So he's expected at the RNC, which starts on the 18th of this month in Cleveland, Ohio. Ryan is expected to be, or he's been cast at least by the New York Times and others, as being the figure who's tasked with uniting the party behind Trump. Now, he himself has never really openly embraced Trump. It's been a sort of reluctant embracing, right? Yeah. So he himself is not sending a message of unity. I mean, how is this going to work out?
I mean, this is just the chaos that the Republican Party is faced with right now. I mean, it's very clear that Paul Ryan has significant ideological differences with Trump, whether it's over trade policy or whether it's over Social Security and Medicaid, where Trump seems to want to preserve it and Ryan wants to change the systems and cut them and put them into privatization. These are really kind of fundamental differences between the standard bearer of the party and the figure who is the leader in the Congress. And I don't know if those can be reconciled in any real way. It's going to be a pretty remarkable speech writing job for Ryan and whoever it is writing his speech to try to unify these very disparate elements of the party. You know, Trump is certainly running on this nativist idea of closing up our borders and raising tariffs and raising walls. This is just sort of against all these things that the Republican Party said they had to do an autopsy about how they were not reaching out to people of color after the 2012 election, where they got battered in those identity groups. And I don't know what Ryan's going to do to kind of surmount that. The Republican Party created this monster, and now they really don't know what to do with it.
And I'm so glad you put it in that way. I mean, in many ways, this is almost a natural outcome of the very dangerous games the party has been playing for many, many years. Let's talk about, in terms of values and issues that you alluded to, the Republican National Convention Platform Committee meetings took place on Monday, and they were televised, and there was Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, the sort of leader of the social conservatism movement in the United States, was one of the committee members. And what sort of clash do you see happening between Trump's stated values and some of these, anti-gay marriage, anti-transgender people being able to use bathrooms folks, anti-abortion folks? Trump has actually come out on the opposite side of some of these issues in the past. And it's interesting to see figures like Perkins try to reconcile their issues with Trump's.
Yeah, I guess I don't think that Trump has any coherent philosophy with respect to those particular social issues. And so he sort of gave away the platform to allow these social conservatives to sort of adopt it. And that's most of what you heard coming out of the platform on the Republican side, was all of these social issues, whether it was the bathroom law in North Carolina or issues around gay marriage, same-sex marriage, transgender rights, things like that. This was sort of the bone that was thrown to those social conservatives. Trump has sort of made no bones about saying, yeah, I agree with you, whatever issue you want. He famously went to Liberty University and, botched the name of the Bible verse. He said 2 Corinthians, so I feel like this has no relevance to Trump. He doesn't care about it. And so if they want to put some things in the platform, he feels like he can dance around it, and it's not going to affect his campaign in any real way.
And how much of this has to do with the fact that the party platforms are not really that important anyway? When people pay attention to them, but Ultimately, they just provide maybe the most general directions for either the Republican or Democratic Party.
Yeah, the platforms are non-binding, and they really only are what the individuals within the party make of them. I think the Democratic platform process was extremely healthy, and it really provided a snapshot of where most rank-and-file Democrats are at this stage. And you can look at the trends over time and see that the party is shifting to a more populist vision. And that's important in and of itself. It doesn't mean that every individual running on the Democratic Party line is somehow forced to adopt those policies. It doesn't mean that the sense of the Congress or the presidency has to take every one of those in line, but it's something that you can hold those elected officials to. And I think that it does have value and it does have weight. And it will have weight in the Republican process as well. I mean, if you're just giving over your platform to social conservatives, it is going to be harder down the line to then betray those social conservatives with policies, whether it's relative to abortion or relative to gay rights or whatever it is. So, yeah.
So finally, let's just spend a moment on the Democrats, who ultimately, despite the huge challenge that Sanders gave to Hillary Clinton, have a far neater process, a far less messy situation right now. You know, basically everybody's fallen in line with Hillary Clinton, the very last and most prominent holdout being Bernie Sanders himself, who had a campaign stop in New Hampshire this week, came out and formally endorsed Clinton. The big question is, in holding out for as long as he did he exact a high enough price for his endorsement of Hillary Clinton in terms of influence to the platform, influence to her campaign promises?
Yeah, I think he did, actually. And certainly there were those mainstream Democrats that were, you know, sort of begging for him to just get out already and have enough of this. We're, you know,
he was under tremendous pressure for weeks now.
Yeah, it's been a month since the last primary, and he waited and waited. And I think he did maximize what he could get out of that. The platform, there is no question, is the most progressive in history.
Which isn't saying that much if you are true progressive, but for the Democrats.
True enough, but there are planks in there that are really pretty strong, and he didn't get everything he wanted. But Sanders did exact a price, and now he has a tool that he can use in the future, whether through the Senate or whether through outside organizing, to really remake the Democratic Party kind of in the image that he wants to see. And he can give that to his supporters and say, look, this is the party platform. This is what the party believes they stand for. And it's up to you now to hold them to that. And so he did the best he could. Obviously, the electoral process has its own kind of structure, and there is only one winner, and Hillary Clinton is going to be the nominee. But I think that he made the best of what, you know, inevitably is kind of a bad hand.
And well, finally, do you feel that that in many ways those people who were strong supporters of Bernie Sanders would have liked to have seen him, you know, just not come out and formally endorse her? That in endorsing her, even if he did manage to influence the Democratic Party, that this inside strategy is not going to work, because in the end, the Democrats, the establishment of the Democratic Party, will just, you know, push over and get what they want, bow down to Wall Street, that Sanders should have just held back, you know, and stepped away and stood apart from it all.
We'll have to see what happens in the coming days and weeks. But just because he endorsed in this binary contest where he said, yes, Hillary Clinton is a better choice for president than Donald Trump, doesn't necessarily mean that he cannot exert influence as an outside force upon the Democratic Party. So really what matters is not necessarily the election, but what happens in the months and weeks after that election. Who gets appointed to those key personnel positions within a hypothetical Clinton presidency? What is done within the Senate if it's in Democratic hands? so that the Sanders wing or the Elizabeth Warren wing can exert pressure and make sure that their vision is actualized. There's a lot that can be done to sort of play this sort of inside-outside game, and it remains to be seen whether his supporters, those that backed Sanders throughout this primary process, will continue to stay engaged. There are some signs that they will, and there are some signs that some of them will move on. And hopefully, what comes out of this is this idea that democracy is very difficult, and there are wins and losses along the way. And if you walk off the field, that's the only way that you definitely lose. So we'll see what happens in the coming weeks.
Well, that said, I have great sympathy for those people who really feel the system is designed to not allow the Bernie Sanders of the world to be legitimately and fairly part of the process. And those people may walk away saying, I'm just done. And, you know, frankly, who can blame them? But, you know, anyway, we'll see what happens. David, I will see you in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us. Oh, and by the way, you're still on book tour. Give out a website where people who haven't heard about it yet can still catch your speaking events.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be doing events in the coming weeks in St. Louis and Philadelphia and here in Los Angeles and also in the Bay Area in San Francisco and parts of the East Bay. You can go to facebook.com/chainoftitlebook. And if you click on the events page there, you'll see all of the places where I'll be appearing over the next few months. And I hope to see you out there.
Good luck to you, David, and thanks always for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
David Dayan is a contributor to The Salon and The Intercept and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times and The New Republic. And we'd had him on recently to talk about his new book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. You can find that interview on our website. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.